Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, store news, and whatever games, movies, and TV is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show. Welcome to Roguecast episode 226, or I like to call it Captain Marvel Day.
It is.
I've been waiting for this trailer forever.
Yeah, now you'll shut up forever.
Nope,
because now he wants another trailer.
Right, yeah. Well, it was good, so...
Yeah, it was good, so... And we'll talk about that. But yeah, before we get to that, I guess we should do store news.
Talk
about the stuff. So, our October, November is a little quieter, but we do still have a few things in September. So this weekend, Starfinder Munchkin launch weekend, so you can come out and play Starfinder Munchkin and possibly win a copy of Starfinder Munchkin 2 and get some free promo stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to start doing...
When is that this weekend?
That is Saturday, September 22nd.
Okay. And like what's the span?
I don't remember.
Okay. I'm going
to
say 2 to 5.
It's on the website. Why do you ask me questions like this? I don't know.
I don't know, because we're giving the information out to the people who need to
know. He only updates the website. He only makes the website. He doesn't remember.
People can go to the website for more specific information.
Fair enough.
We're old men. We can't remember things.
Star Wars X-Wing was very successful for us.
Yes.
It's done well. We still have, of course, you know, we were still selling all that. We still have all the core sets, all that. But, so we thought we might try doing Star Wars X-Wing nights. So starting on Monday, September 24th, at 6:45 to 9 o'clock.
Oh, nice.
That make you happy, Dave?
Kinda. which will be, that's the this coming Monday, right?
Yes, it is. So that is actually our HeroClix night as well, but we feel like we have room enough for people to come play some X-Wing as well. There's been a lot of interest, so if you want to come out and play X-Wing, hopefully there'll be people there to, help you walk through it. We also will have our core set demo available, so people can play it if they don't have it. But hopefully people will bring their own ships, and we'll get cool Star Wars X-Wing battles going. Magic the Gathering, Guilds of Ravnica pre-release weekend is next weekend. That's Saturday, September 29th, and Sunday, September 30th. We have one pre-release on Saturday night, starting at 5, and 2 on Sunday, basically running all day.
Yep. And Magic is also doing their promotional stuff, so like participants can pick up guild packs.
Booster boxes. And introductory... Well, people playing in the pre-release can buy intro packs.
Intro packs, but other folks can buy booster boxes,
yep,
right?
Yep.
Both days.
Yep.
Yep.
So yeah, you can get a jump on the new Magic set. All right, news. Let's just start by talking about the Captain Marvel trailer.
Yep.
We just watched it again.
Yep. Yeah, it's like teaser trailer
it's
style.
Very much a teaser. Like, I don't know what's going on in most of it.
Yep. But we did kind of get some sense that in some ways you pointed out when we just rewatched Randy, it's a very clever bit of a period piece establishment.
Yep.
She crash lands in a Blockbuster video.
Yep. Yeah, you're like, oh, well,
nothing more 90s than that, other than dead Kurt Cobain. I don't know.
Right.
And some kids are going to be like, what the hell is a Blockbuster?
And then their parents will get to tell them, let me tell you of the times of yore.
That's true. I have many memories of Blockbuster.
Gandalf style. I have no memory of this place. Yes, they'll be able to tell their kids that there was a time when you didn't watch streaming movies, you didn't watch stuff on your phone. You would go out and you would try and find that right videotape, and if it was gone, you had to pick something shitty.
That's right. You would look at the thing, you would see a movie you wanted, and then you would look behind the box and discover there was no Blockbuster box behind it, so the movie was out.
See, I would always go up to the counter and because the guys working there always had a slew of movies just sitting on the counter waiting to go back.
Nick, you worked in a video store. You knew the secrets.
I did.
Yeah. We're not part of this lore.
It was sort of a family thing. My sister actually managed a Blockbuster, and then
Randy and I were like bots in a video game where we were just kind of like walking against the wall in like a frozen walking motion.
Yeah, I would bump into the wall numerous times.
And just hope things would happen.
Until a copy of Navy SEALs fell into my hand, and then I would go and rent it.
It is funny because I can recall with movies I saw at the theater, I can recall specific good movie rentals and video game rentals. Like, oh man, that time, that weekend I rented GoldenEye was like the best time, or you know, that kind of thing.
I have specific memories of when HEB used to rent movies.
Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't just Blockbuster.
Dude, I remember, I'll throw it back to, like, the 80s, and, like, I remember, like, when video stores were first popping up, and I was, like, be it, like, a half-priced, like, but small, business owner, not half-priced books, but a small half-priced books type store that had cats and shit, and they would have, like, 30 video cassettes. Like, that was it. That was the whole library. But let's take it back to Captain Marvel.
Anyway, yes, she crashes into a Blockbuster, and it's clearly come from space. And then we see a bunch of jumbled things with her talking to a two-eyed younger Samuel Jackson.
Yep.
Which, by the way, looks great.
Dead on special effects. The way that they are doing that now is so impressive, and the Marvel movies totally lead the way.
Yep.
I've seen it, like, it's kind of funny because, like, I think about, like, the way, like, Carrie Fisher and Tarkin looked in Star Wars, and I'm like, I mean, I know those were entirely CG creations.
That's the problem. It wasn't de-aging.
Well, they might have keyed off of, like, a person's facial features for the mouth movements and facial tics and stuff like that, but it wasn't, like, a regular person modified. The Marvel seems to do the regular person, like, full person who is the actual actor, modified. And so they what have they done it with? Well, at least two before.
They did Tony Stark.
And who was the
Michael
other
Douglas.
One?
Douglas.
And Michael Douglas.
Michael Douglas. And they were both pretty flawless.
The issue and then Michelle Pfeiffer in the last
episode. Yeah.
The issue with it is that those are actors who are alive.
Right.
The two that they did...
That's true.
They did have motion capture. I mean, it was an actor for Princess Leia and for Tarkin, but it's not the actor, and that's a different kind of skill.
Right.
So they haven't gotten that yet, but the de-aging is great. Also, we get a little nod. Coulson's in there at one point. We saw him.
You see these glimpses of her past, or what she thinks is her past, because clearly her memories are jumbled.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And they show her, like, as a kid, training to join the Air Force, I'm guessing, and then, like, actually, like, on the like, the deck, the
tarmac.
Flight deck, yeah, and stuff. And including with the mother of...
Monica Rambeau. Yep.
And definitely there's a vibe that she's a person who has kind of, like, in those flashbacks, who struggled. You know, she gets knocked down, she gets up again, just like the song.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is she was part of the Kree, like, they're Navy SEALs. They're Star Force.
Right.
Yeah. That's the second Navy SEALs mentioned so far. Listen for a third.
if that happens, do we summon Michael Biehn?
Yeah, he shows up. And he's
like, where's my career? Now that's mean.
Love Michael Biehn. Charlie Sheen.
Sadly, he is the more likely one to be summoned.
So she was clearly in some kind of Kree Special Missions Force. There's no sense of, like, I'm going to guess basically they were going to, like, annex Earth or something, and that's how she goes to Earth. Like, she was fighting the Skrulls, and then, like, the Kree Skrull War is coming to Earth.
Right.
We see her punch out an old lady.
Right.
Either a Skrull, or Marvel's going a very interesting direction with Captain Marvel. Her foe is old people. She can't stand them.
There's going to be... in some ways, I see that scene, which is going to be bewildersome. I think Honor was already saying some of her friends were like, what is up with
Why
that?
Why did she punch an old lady?
But it's clever because then longtime fans get to go, let me tell you about the Skrulls and stuff like that. And
that
you get to
great.
Kind of be the... We get to be the lore keepers
the
and stuff like that.
The old wise men.
It's clever because it makes the nerds feel all good about themselves. Yeah.
Not all the nerds, but that's a different story. I like the costume, looks great.
Yeah,
oh yeah, it looks fantastic.
They're clearly giving her, like,
multiple costumes. Of course, we've got her Kree costume and a regular costume.
And we even got the mohawk.
And we see the helmet.
Very briefly glimpsed,
which is fantastic.
The Skrulls look really good. I still don't know what their origin's going to be like. And I like that she has such a weird comic book origin, because you've got... Kree experimentation, losing her powers to Rogue, becoming binary, losing those powers, becoming Warbird, becoming Captain Marvel, and they can't do all of that.
Yep.
So I like that they're going to give her a more compressed origin that will no doubt sort of make its way into the Marvel Universe.
Yep. Well, you know, even looking at Spider-Man Homecoming, Marvel Studios took a very familiar origin that everybody knew and basically completely dropped the traditional origin tropes, all the Uncle Ben stuff like that, and rebuilt it as a fresh concept. Where, like, even old fans would be surprised. And arguably, it was one of the things that kind of jarred me when I watched the movie, but I do think they did a great job with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got a character like Captain Marvel, who has this jumbled history, and pulling that together is going to be a different sort of challenge. But one of the things I kind of like about these movies is seeing them kind of do what Batman the Animated Series did, that 2020 hindsight stuff, you know? Fix a jumbled origin, make a character who wasn't super compelling before, even if we kind of liked them. And I'm not just talking to her, I'm talking like lots of Marvel characters. Like, I don't think Drax had a ton of fans.
No.
But a lot of people like movie Drax.
Yeah.
And it just as that's just a random example, and they've done it with tons of them. So it's kind of exciting to not know what to expect is what I'm ultimately getting at.
Yeah. So... I'm curious. It sounds like maybe the Skrulls are a new threat. Like, Nick Fury sounds like he talks about maybe, you know, he was about to hang it up, and then there's all this excitement.
Yep.
I really want there to be a line where Nick Fury is like, yeah, we've known about the Skrulls for a while. A bunch of them turned themselves into cows or something like that. Like, just a line.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah.
And you know Marvel does that kind of stuff. Like, that I would be cool. A little fan service.
It would be cool. You know, he said he was about to hang it up. Do we have any notion as to why?
I think he was bored.
Well, I was just thinking, like, well, we thought the Cold War ended in, what, 91?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or so?
Yeah.
So and if this is the mid-90s, he might be like...
the Cold War running, he's like, yeah.
Exactly. It's kind of like what they sort of, they kind of did in their sort of weird way with the Bond movies, even though, I mean, yeah, they showed that this was a guy who might not have an enemy to fight anymore.
Yeah.
And I imagine that Fury could be at that same place if it's mid-90s, and it should be.
Also... If superheroes went sort of underground in the 90s, you know, basically it was all gone, and
yeah.
S.H.I.E.L.D. became sort of an anti-alien force for a few years,
yeah.
That would explain why they were sort of gone until Iron Man showed up in 2008.
Right.
If Nick was off fighting a secret war, if you will, or a secret invasion.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I don't know. This was very exciting. I've seen some people. I've seen a couple.
Honestly, they haven't used that either of those terms,
no,
right?
They have not.
No.
But if Nick Fury at some point, if Samuel Jackson at some point says he's like, we're gonna have to go out of the picture, he's like, this isn't a normal kind of war. This will be a secret war.
Yeah.
People are gonna freak their shit.
I've seen most people seem to be pretty happy with it. I've seen a couple of people on my Facebook page were like, ah. Kind of an underwhelming teaser, because it is just a teaser.
Well, you know, it's sort of like, I sort of thought that at first, but on revisit, I'm like, there's lots of neat little hooks in there. The feel is there of something, you know, that this is going to be, you know, you talked about, Randy, you think that they're going to sort of present her almost as Marvel Superman, and that level of kind of importance. And we talked about, you know, if that's the person who Nick Fury is going to call when there's the worst alien stuff happening in why can't I suddenly
Infinity
say
Infinity War?
Infinity War, then that puts her on a pretty high level.
Yeah,
the music and everything kind of felt like that.
Yeah.
It felt like, you know, like a first teaser trailer for a Superman movie or something like that.
I think the thing I've seen is I think a lot of people they want exactly what I don't want. They want to know what's going to happen in the movie, and I'm like, I do not. I specifically don't want the trailer to tell me that.
A teaser trailer is good for establishing tone, a few initial like hooks and mysteries and things like that, and give you some little glimpses of some of the stuff you hope to see.
But this one friend, by the way, specifically did mention, he's like, it didn't have the same feel as the Wonder Woman teaser, which I disagree with. I was not in love with the
Actually,
Wonder Woman teaser.
Can't quite remember what happened in the Wonder Woman teaser.
I remember thinking that I was not as impressed with it. And the other thing, and this is why you know my friend is crazy, he was like, he's like, yeah, I mean, they've had their drop balls, like Michael B. Jordan as Killmonger. And I'm like, what?
I've actually never heard anybody say those words.
No, why would you? Michael B. Jordan was amazing as Killmonger.
Vulture, and Loki are their three best villains.
Wow, and Thanos.
Killmonger, Vulture, and
Loki. You're going to do that.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. That's what I'm going there.
All right.
At least those guys weren't little cartoon baby men.
What?
I like Thanos, too. He was fine.
There
are some fun Easter eggs in there, too. Like the pager and the...
Yeah.
That is a callback to Infinity War. And apparently the... I didn't catch it, but the poster that they released along with it that I think Randy made his Facebook...
It's a great poster.
At the very bottom corner of it, there's a cat running through it because Carol does have a cat.
Oh, that's cool.
Whose name is Chewy.
Yep.
They're definitely doing some Easter egg fan service type stuff, which I love.
That's pretty cool. And here's the thing, it's like, teaser trailers, like, if some people don't like it, I don't think that's a big thing. Same way it was not a big thing, particularly that you didn't like the Wonder Woman teaser trailer or didn't connect with you. It's their first kind of like test run, it's not going to fit for everybody, but I definitely feel like, for my purposes, they came through with it.
Yeah, me too. And the other thing, the thing that bugs me is like, I understand, like, all your friends are posting about it, but I don't understand one that on, like, day one, hour one of the trailer, you're like, not impressed. Like,
yeah.
What's wrong with you?
You've said that for plenty of movies, so.
But not...
You know what I think? I think the movies that people are already inclined to not be wild about, I've had that reaction to trailers before, you know, where it's something where I'm like, Deadpool is too obvious a thing. I feel like there's movies that I'm just not, like, super enthused about.
Yep.
And I can see a trailer that's clearly well put together, and it does, like, zero for me because I don't have an overall interest in it. So maybe that's where his head was. I don't know.
Yeah, this is weird. I also watched, because Nick posted in our news thread, the Mary Poppins Returns trailer.
Yep.
Which is not a movie I thought I had any interest in. It's directed by Rob Marshall,
yep.
who did Pretty Woman and what else?
I knew you were going to ask this question.
I know
question.
He's done a bunch of stuff. I've got yeah. IMDb pulled up. I thought you would know. I thought, Nick, you would have
yeah,
a pull.
Yeah, no.
He did Into the Woods, which I hated. He did Chicago, which I love.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's some...
Interesting.
He didn't do Pretty Woman. Was he a producer on it? Huh. I thought he was the director of Pretty okay. Woman. Apparently...
But still, that was Mike Nichol. No.
He's done some...
It was somebody else. Anyway.
He is a director of real movies, which continues the tradition of, you know, Disney getting some people for their these remake sequel-type live-action ones, you know, getting some notable directors
yeah.
and things.
So he's done several musicals. He did Into the Woods, he did Chicago... he did Memoirs of a Geisha and then Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides.
Directed all of these?
Yeah. Huh. He also directed, he's directing The Little Mermaid live action.
Yeah.
Mary Poppins okay. Returns.
Is it a full musical?
It looks to be, as much as the first one was.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the first one had a lot of songs in it.
So, this is basically the kids have grown up.
Mm-hmm.
Jane and Michael have grown up. Played by Emily Mortimer, who I mostly know from Friends. Oh, and The Newsroom. Who's Ben Whishaw, who
I
know
from Harry Potter.
Oh, where else is he from? I know that name. I recognize the kid. But they have grown up to be like 20-somethings.
They forgot about Winnie the Pooh.
They forgot about Winnie the Pooh. Yes.
They forgot about Drake.
Exactly right. They forgot about Drake. Oh, he played the young Q. Ben Whishaw.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Okay, I can see that sort of reedy dude.
So, they've grown up. Michael has three kids.
Mm-hmm.
His wife has died,
mm-hmm.
and so I guess his sister is like moving in to help them. And Mary Poppins, ever young, comes back to help with the kids because Michael has sort of lost his joy, and he's like now the you know filling their heads with stuff and nonsense kind of thing.
Yep. It was interesting because I never got around to seeing the Christopher Robin movie, but that was clearly about a guy who's kind of like weighed down by the responsibilities of adulthood, having to kind of rediscover some childlike
yeah.
magic.
But so she comes back, and she is played by Emily Blunt,
yep,
who looks great in the role.
Yeah.
And also, it seems like they've recast Dick Van Dyke's role as like another street person. His name is Jack.
Yep.
And he's played by Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Yeah.
And Dick Van Dyke is in this as well. Maybe playing one of the guys from the bank, it looks like.
It looks like.
That's pretty good.
Colin Firth is in it. Meryl Streep is in it. Angela
right.
Lansbury.
Yeah.
It is a huge, awesome cast. And the trailer is really sweet and fun and definitely makes me want to see it. It's like, I had zero interest, and the trailer looks like a ton of fun.
I really like Emily Blunt. I think
I like her too.
She's had a pretty amazing career so far, and...
Yeah, you know, I think she was one that I didn't have strong feelings one way or the other than she seemed like a talented actress when I'd see her. And I think when I saw, was it The Girl on the Train? That was
yeah,
her,
that was her.
Right?
Yeah, that was her.
That I was like, oh, okay, she can play some serious depth, too.
Yeah.
Now, this is, I don't know what ultimately this will call for. You got to be able to sing, and you got to be able to pull off the persona is more important than anything.
Yeah,
yeah.
And that's not easy. That's not an easy role.
I'll have to watch the trailer later, because, yeah, that's a damn good cast.
Yeah. And, yeah, the trailer's great, so, and they've got the animation stuff. I mean...
Mm-hmm.
The animation and all that stuff in the original Mary Poppins was super fun, but the technology is advanced, and they're going to be able to play around with it a little more.
And I would imagine Lin-Manuel Miranda is involved in like the music writing and stuff,
oh, yeah.
so
yeah.
I mean, it's going to be good.
Then we have the Chilling Adventures of Sabrina trailer on Netflix.
Yay!
It looked freaky.
Yeah.
It premieres on my anniversary, which I'm excited for.
Nice. No, that's cool, actually.
So it's Kiernan Shipka from Mad Men.
Yep.
And she's great. She's
yeah.
playing Sabrina. It looks creepy.
Well, it looks like
it
kind of Rosemary's Baby.
It is based on the 70s one, right? It is,
yeah.
Is it based on that comic?
I think it's based on the kernel of that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I bet it's not that close to it, though.
Yeah.
I bet
it's dark.
I bet it's dark, but I don't think it's going to use the plot.
Same idea.
I don't think it's going to be set in the 60s, or is it?
It's set in the 60s.
I watched the trailer a few days ago, and I didn't...
It does not look current.
Does it not?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, it looked to me like a period piece.
It looked
yeah.
more period,
okay.
and definitely kind of the look of, like, the witch with, like, some of the demonic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it definitely is interesting.
I guess this will join Riverdale in their kind of, like, you know, teen to adult fair type. Yeah.
Although
Archie
this is
stuff.
Netflix, not CW, right?
Yeah, this is That's Netflix.
It's too bad that they. I mean, I guess there's not a particular need for a crossover in that.
No.
But is Sabrina just a wholly separate license? Yeah. Like, if they ever wanted Sabrina to somehow show up on Riverdale, could
I
they?
I think it's a wholly separate
She could be,
license.
Like, some stage yeah. magician or something.
I don't know if they're going to go traditional CW fare with this. I mean, there will probably yeah. be love interest.
This looks a little darker.
Right. It looks, like, a little bit darker and maybe
Do you think
a
there's anything that it compares to? Like, I can't think of many, like, sort of... I mean, is it, like, more like Veronica Mars, where there's, like, a foot in, like, Sirius, but, like, it's...
I don't know, even that is not quite what
yeah.
I
was trying. Yeah, I'm trying to think, is there anything that's really quite done that, that's like a kind of darker teen story?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head.
Things happen pretty quick in it, so I don't have like strong impressions about like the story or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, it was just... Again, a teaser trailer yeah, that doesn't really give us a sense other than...
It looked cool. It had creepy imagery.
Yeah.
It looked like the characters looked interesting. And for sure subversive as hell based on compared to what people will expect.
And Salem is there.
Yes.
You know,
was that like right at the very end?
Yeah, it was right at the very end.
Did we just see like a cat stroll by
yeah.
or like yeah?
He doesn't speak or anything, and I don't know if they'll do that kind of goofiness.
I think there's a way that you could still do it without being too goofy, but maybe it's something that happens. Maybe she
can
has to make him her familiar.
Can he
or
speak,
like
but
that.
Only speak in like a death metal voice or something?
Well, there was an effect that they did in Princess Mononoke that I thought was super creepy and cool, which was like when that forest god speaks, that like giant stag looking thing. Like its mouth kind of just opens and closes slowly, but you hear words in this like, super scary voice kind of like at a somewhat normal pace. So it has this kind of unearthly quality. They don't try and match it up like lip sync it so it works perfectly. It's more like something mystical is occurring, like he's making sounds, but it's coming out in this creepy human voice. So, I mean, there's definitely ways they could do it if they wanted to.
Yeah.
Or maybe they'll make that the one thing that's exactly like the 90s TV show, and he's a silly, corny cat.
Let's hope not.
That's like a big old, like puppet cat.
Netflix also dropped the trailer for The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which was supposed to be a 6-episode TV series, and it's now apparently a movie by the Coen brothers.
And it was going to be like this anthology series,
yeah.
So presumably this movie will kind of stitch together either all 6 stories, or maybe if they do
so
it somewhat differently.
I'm looking at the IMDb listing, and they have people cast in various segments, and I see like 5 others. Ballad of Buster Scruggs, Meal Ticket, Near Algodonus, The Gal Who Got Rattled, All Gold Canyon, that's 5, and The Mortal Remains. So yeah, apparently they're all still in there.
That's fascinating because they
only do 6 episodes.
Like, so I've, you know, I watched anthology movies kind of was more of a thing when I was growing up, and it has somewhat returned, but it tends to be a horror thing. Creepshow,
yeah.
VHS more
yeah.
recently.
Trick-or-Treat.
Yeah, Trick-or-Treat was another, is a somewhat more good
but
recent example.
But how do you do 6 satisfying stories in one movie? That's crazy.
I mean, they may be thinking about it on a different level. They may be like, well, you know, maybe one of these things, you know, is going to be a 10-minute, like, you know, short story that, like, frames it. You know, if you think almost like...
Is it possible
you know,
it's
like
a 4.5-hour-long movie?
It's possible.
You know, like, Sin City had that that intro sequence with the guy
yeah.
on the...
Yeah.
Out on the balcony?
Yep.
Was that Josh Hartnett?
It was.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And, you know, one of the segments could be as short as that.
That's true.
Conceivably,
that's true.
And it could, but, like, it might set in motion... You know, events in another because I don't know if they're gonna like be linked.
I don't know.
Does Sam Shepard come out and spin a tale of like of
well,
all of these and narrate them?
Here's the thing: I never get the sense that the Coen brothers are ever forced into doing anything.
Yeah,
I feel like if they were like we're gonna do a TV series and they're like let's just make it a movie, guys, they probably would have said. Okay, we're out.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I agree completely. Like, those guys can write their own
I feel like they're going to be like, you know, something about this, we want to do a movie out of this.
Right,
yeah.
Like, maybe they felt...
So,
but I'm disappointed because I wanted a 6-episode TV series by the Coens. I'm a TV
fan
over
That's
because
you're a
super
movies. TV nerd.
Yes.
Yep.
And so I'm disappointed that it's going to be a movie
I'm
and
a movie
TV
fan
series.
Over TV, and I'm ecstatic.
Yeah.
Because it looked good.
The trailer
Here's
looks,
the thing
the
is...
The trailer looks great.
I didn't watch the trailer. I forgot about it.
You didn't watch the trailer? Oh, man. It
like, so much
super
happens
fun.
That I don't know quite how to describe it, but it is there is that mixture of, like... I mean, I guess the closest thing I can think of is like...
Who's the lead actor?
So, there's not. Tim Blake Nelson is playing Buster Scruggs.
Yeah, Tim Blake Nelson.
And then there's also, it seems like James Franco seems like he was somewhat prominent in the trailer.
He's playing Cowboy.
Okay, I'll buy it.
So let me read down this cast a little bit. Zoe Kazan, David Krumholtz, James Franco, Liam Neeson, Clancy Brown, Brendan Gleeson, Tim Blake Nelson, Stephen Root, Tom Waits, Saul Rubinek, Tyne Daly. There's a ton of people in this.
Yeah.
I mean, that reads like a Coen Brothers movie.
Yeah.
And people kind of jump
Was Tyne Daly in Spider-Man Homecoming? Was she the...
Yeah,
person
yeah,
who
she
shut
was.
Down
she
the,
was damage control.
Yeah.
In this, she plays Lady.
I the other day we were talking about No Country for Old Men, and one of my favorite scenes is the lady who runs the trailer park who talks crap to the scariest killer in like recent movie history. And it's just like, we won't give you out give out the names of people in our trailers. Tyne Daly could have that role and still be just Lady and still have an amazing role.
So 2 hours and 12 minutes is the runtime, by the
That's
way.
That's a not overly long movie. Yeah. That's pretty standard.
They're going to release in theaters as well. But yeah, the trailer is so good.
It is. And there's super weird and funny looking... I mean, I get the sense that there's gonna be drama and stuff in there too.
Yeah, sure.
It reminded me of like True Grit, their version of it still had some very quirky humor in it.
Sure.
It reminded me of like everything looked like it was at least in that kind of quirky vein, True Grit at its quirkiest.
Right.
And then some scenes turned up to more Coen 11.
Right.
But I thought it looked fantastic.
Yeah, it's really good. Alright, so that's the trailer news. The big DC news, and I guess this is still not 100% confirmed, but it seems pretty confirmed, is that Henry Cavill is out as Superman at DC, and that DC is going to redo their entire universe again.
Well, do we know that?
I don't know that second half.
Well, they're just going to bring somebody else in as Superman, because Henry Cavill wasn't the problem.
Right, but they...
No, Zack Snyder was your problem.
Yeah.
But they also... They have, potentially they've got that Flashpoint movie coming up, which would allow them to reconfigure anything on the chessboard should they want to.
If that actually happens.
Right. I mean, if anything, but there that seems just as likely as they're going to reboot.
Yeah.
There was like a tweet or something from Henry Cavill, though.
Yeah.
Where he said something like, the cape is still in my closet. And that sounds sort of like, I don't, nothing has changed.
I feel like he stole the cape from the set. I mean, he's like, cape's in my closet again.
That's the thing. It's not a real clear tweet. Yeah. It could be.
I think he means literally he has the cape. Or he is saying, even though I quit, Superman is still in my heart. The cape is still in my closet.
Yeah. Or maybe he meant the cape has not come out of the closet yet, but does need to let the world know a secret.
Maybe he meant that he is going to star in a big budget reboot of that NBC cape? Show, The Cape.
Yeah, I was going to make that joke too. I mean, this is what the community warned us about.
You know, Keith David is still around. Wasn't he the guy
he was?
Who was like
the evil ringmaster, right?
No, he was the guy who trained him to use his cape.
There was an evil circus, am I not right?
I think you're right. So. I didn't watch much.
Man,
of
the cape was terrible.
You know, I thought the first episode was kind of fun, but it was a very corny kind of fun. But I like corny, so.
You don't like fun. You don't like humor.
But I just said that I did.
But you like corny.
I sometimes do.
I see.
I was, I did, the first exceptions. Batman I ever saw was the 60s Batman in reruns.
Okay.
So there you go. About Henry Cavill. I don't know how the other rumor got started that, like, they were considering, Michael B. Jordan as a possible replacement. Now, that one might, like... Does anybody know where it started?
I think that's got to be just crazy.
Is that just
fan
talk?
I think it's just internet.
Because I like it.
But it showed up on IGN.
Yeah, it was IGN.
Yeah. Here's the thing. If that came to pass, if say Flashpoint happens, there's some world hopping, and that's just like, that's just the Superman who is the Superman now.
Yeah.
Things just changed or whatever.
I love the idea.
Or some worlds merged or whatever they want, however they want to do it. I think Michael G. Borden...
Michael B.
G. Borden?
Michael G. Borden.
That's his Bizarro World incarnation.
Yeah, he's from New York, too.
Michael B. Jordan has the acting chops, the physique, and the kind of, like... And can play the heart, too, to pull it off. I would be behind it.
Yeah.
So,
the other bit of DC news is Joaquin Phoenix Joker picture came out.
Oh, yeah, I didn't see that.
It's just Joaquin Phoenix with longer hair.
With longer hair,
so,
yeah.
You know that picture that David Venable did for us that has that was based on the Nicholas, what's his name?
Nick Nolte.
His arrest mugshot. Photo, yeah.
So he turned him into the Joker?
His mugshot.
It looks like that, except less Jokery.
Yep. Yeah, like there's no makeup. It literally just looks like Joaquin Phoenix, kind of scary looking. Like
a bender.
I feel like there's a little bit of an Anton Chigurh vibe, to take it back to No Country for Old Men. Just in the sense that he's got a kind of serious, scary kind of face going on. Just his own normal face is scary. And
your face is scary.
I didn't follow the link to it, but they said that there was, like, did they outline something about how his Joker is going to be? Did anybody read that?
They didn't really, like, go into detail on what his Joker is going to be, but it's like, he's like a stand-up comedian, and then there's, like, what will happen if this, like, a... people are ignoring him or take him for granted, and like he goes evil. It felt very kind of real worldish, and yeah. I was a little kind of put off by
the comedian thing. I think kind of came out of the Killing Joke.
Yeah,
I don't remember it ever being part of the origin until then. And even then, you know, even Alan Moore allowed that
he remembers it different every time.
Yeah.
So Nick, you were sort of not into this, I think.
No, it doesn't really vibe with the Joker that I want. I mean, I guess I don't know if I really want a Joker movie to begin with.
I definitely don't want a Joker movie, but I feel like
I don't want
he will bring something to the park, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, I mean, Joaquin Phoenix is fine.
It's a weird way to promote it, is a shot that by no one stretch of the imagination makes somebody instantly think of Joker. He just looks like a kind of scary guy.
Yeah. There's no talk of, like, if they're going to not have the face paint or if they're not going to go that route.
Right.
Or if this is going to be sort of more real world where, I mean, are they going to even mention Batman? I don't know.
Yeah. Who's directing? Who's writing? And do we know any of that stuff?
Yes. It's all got announced.
Oh, okay.
Like, more people got... Like, I know Alec Baldwin was supposed to be Thomas Wayne, but he left.
Todd Phillips is directing.
Todd Phillips.
You might know him as the guy who did Road Trip, Old School, Starsky and Hutch, The Hangover Trilogy, Due Date, and War Dogs.
That's right.
Oh, and Borat.
That's right.
So he has a mode.
That's weird.
That is weird.
That is super weird.
Well, everybody knows comedians all have this dark side.
Yeah.
And that he seems to be squarely in the comedic movie camp.
I'm going to pitch Hangover 4, Penguin, Joker, Riddler, all in Vegas.
Yep.
And then I guess Solomon Grundy would be the Mike Tyson role.
Like, Penguin wakes up from a bender, and they've like drawn genitals on his face.
Yeah, they were.
He's like, wah!
They were there for. They were there. Joker and Harley were to get married.
Anyway,
see, that sounds more interesting to me than what
it's
we're gonna.
And also, like, Joaquin Phoenix as the Joker, it is hard to imagine it being anything other than like this pretty scary, super dark ass movie.
Yeah.
But maybe we'll see the first teaser for that, and I'll be like, oh, that's not what I expected.
That's not Todd Phillips. Nothing he's made suggests that that's what he would make.
But I did, I thought that, you know, basically, as of Wonder Woman, that they were probably going to be retooling the directions and all their stuff. So, and this is the one that feels the least like a continuation of kind of...
I think DC may have just come to the conclusion that they don't... It doesn't matter what if they do a cohesive universe.
Yeah, they've done it with their comics.
They're just wanting to do whatever the hell they want. Because they're going to do Wonder Woman 1984. They're going to do this Joker. They're going to do the...
There's occasionally an argument to be made that... I mean, you know, obviously Marvel owns the shared universe thing.
Yeah.
But DC at times during their peaks, and Marvel at times during their peaks, have had creators who are like so notable that they're basically just off doing their own thing in their book. Frank Miller is a super obvious example where his Batman Year One did not jibe with current DC history then, had all kinds of continuity problems, but was such a notable story that everybody loved it, and it's still legendary, like, you know, 3 decades later.
I don't think it's the craziest thing for DC to go that direction. Like you say, Marvel owns the shared universe space.
Yeah.
And everybody wanted to replicate it, and it's really tough.
For DC to decide to do their own, like, individual movies, that makes a lot of sense. However, it's still not going to be what I want, because the big appeal of the superhero universes to me is the shared universe aspect.
Yeah.
I want a world where Green Lantern and Batman and Superman and Green Arrow all coexist. And if they can't do that, then to me they've failed. Now, that doesn't mean those movies aren't going to be perfectly good, but they're probably not going to be for me. So
I think it just comes down to me for as a case by case basis on whether or not I have any interest. Because I mean, a Joker movie on its surface, I have no interest in. But if a trailer wins me over,
yeah, I'll have to see what they do with it.
I'm trying to remember the last Joaquin Phoenix movie.
Usually, I can like start thinking about a movie and think like sort of devil's advocate for the story and try and think like, oh, you know what would be cool is if they did this. It's hard with the Joker. He's just a straight up serial killer type guy. Yeah. Now, like, if you broaden the cast a little bit, if you somehow work in like the Red Hood origin, maybe there's another Red Hood that he's vying for power with. Maybe Harley is in there.
Well,
maybe some other characters.
Thomas Wayne is in this too.
That's weird.
It's super weird.
Do you think they're gonna make it out that like, are they gonna redo the thing where like in the Batman 89 where he killed the Waynes?
God,
you know,
I hope
is
not.
It gonna be a is it gonna be, turn out to be like there's a scheme involving that?
Basically,
like,
a fall
like,
from his comedian days to being just a run of the mill guy in the street who mugs and
I was thinking of like it was a like political killing kind of thing or whatever. Did they do that in the Nolan movies? Did like Ra's al Ghul like
they did in the comics?
Ra's al Ghul killed.
He got the Waynes killed, right?
Yeah, he got the Waynes killed
because they were part of that. He
basically
wants the city to collapse, and they were like pillars
trying
of
to,
goodness,
keep it from falling.
Right, but yeah, and that's it. So that story's been done too. Like they can't quite do that angle. I could see it in a Joker story.
Or maybe this is going to be this guy's version of Natural Born Killers starring a Joker. I don't know.
Todd Phillips did Due Date, which had Zach Galifianakis and Robert Downey Jr. As like in a weird buddy comedy where they had to go across the country in a truck.
I remember not being super impressed.
So here's what I'm suggesting.
Okay, go ahead.
Thomas Wayne and the Joker.
Yep.
Buddy road movie.
We'll workshop it and throw it in front of a test audience and see what they think.
You have to remember, I think this is all a terrible idea, so if it's super weird, it's much more likely to get my interest.
I can almost imagine a almost Tarantino-esque, you don't know what's going to happen next in a Joker movie kind of movie, like think Pulp Fiction.
Or
Natural Born Killers. But let's go with Pulp Fiction because it's more obvious quality. Where it encompasses his origin. Maybe he does have some sort of, not necessarily thinking that it's following that, just more like the unpredictability of it.
Same thing
that you get in like Inglourious Bastards and stuff like that.
If Tarantino was doing this movie, I'd be interested in it. But Todd Phillips is doing this movie.
Yeah, who knows?
We'll see. I honestly, like you, Dave, I have no conception of what this could possibly
be. I would have to see a teaser before I can even really kind of begin to formulate an opinion beyond, I don't particularly want a Joker movie. I like Joaquin Phoenix. He's a great actor.
Yeah. Peter Calloway, who is a guy who's been done Cloak and Dagger and Legion on TV, is going to adapt Alan Wake for television. They're pitching it to studios, so it's not a done deal by any means.
Do people remember what Alan Wake was? That was like a decade ago.
I don't.
If people don't remember, it was a horror game.
Wasn't it a horror game where you actually didn't have, like, a gun or anything? You were armed with just a flashlight?
Actually, you did get a gun.
Or you were, like, a cop,
I played it a little bit. Nope. You were a writer. Alan Wake is, like, a Stephen King-type analog. He, I think, had a writer's block, and, like, his agent or whatever in the opening says, like, hey, you need to go get some fresh air. There's this, you know, quiet little... community, like vacation community, out in the woods. Go out there, rest your mind, recharge your batteries, and weird shit happens. And it like has stuff to do with his novels and stuff too. Huh. So there's like this kind of meta element.
Interesting premise.
It did have a lot of scenes that used shadows and light. The flashlight thing, you are remembering that, right, though. Where there's these weird shadow creatures. I didn't finish the game, but it was pretty good and scary. You would have to like run between pools of light. In a truck stop, and you can see these shadow creatures kind of moving around, and you have to kind of like jump between the little pools of light, or where get into a car's headlights and stuff like that. They came up with all kinds of interesting ways to do that.
I remember people being generally happy with the game.
Yeah, it was well received. You would weaken the creatures sometimes with a flashlight or something like that, and then it would almost like I think kind of melt away the shadowiness of them, and you could plug them with a gun or something underneath. In any case, it had a pretty decent story behind it. I don't remember it being like an execution great, but like the underlying premise was pretty solid.
It had like a novel and stuff too, if I'm not mistaken.
It would make sense.
Prose.
It would make sense if they did that.
Yeah.
So they're gonna adapt it for.
They're working on TV, but they it's
that
they're
would
gonna
make
pitch
sense.
To
do we got a network?
No,
we
they're
got
gonna
any
pitch
it
to studios.
Okay, I kind of like the idea.
I could see Amazon, Hulu, Netflix picking
up. Yeah, I don't know if it'll be anywhere near as good as the horror of author Garth Marenghi.
Garth Marenghi's Dark Place.
People need to look up Garth Marenghi's Dark Place, 6-episode UK series that's amazingly hilarious, and you'll recognize some of the actors from shows like The IT Crowd and stuff like that.
So they're doing a Charlie's Angels reboot.
I'm with you.
Coming out next year.
Charlie, how you angels get down like that?
It's being directed by Elizabeth Banks. It's Kristen Stewart, Naomi Scott, and Ella Balinska. I only know one of those actresses, and I'm not a huge fan.
Uh-huh.
But the interesting thing is that it's going to be... Elizabeth Banks is co-writing, producing, and directing, which she did with the Pitch Perfect movies.
Yes.
The Pitch Perfect 2, at least, I think. I don't know if she did anything involved with 3. But... it's coming out in September next year.
Movie? Did you say or TV?
It's a movie.
Okay.
So they just announced that Patrick Stewart will be playing Bosley.
So weird.
He'll be playing one of the Bosleys.
Are they going to do a James Bond style
thing?
One
of the others will be played by Elizabeth Banks. They all work for the mysterious Charlie Townsend. And they're updating the concept so that instead of being a detective agency in L.A., it is a security and intelligence aid organization that has branches across the globe, as well as turning the angels into legacy heroes.
So are they going to acknowledge the previous?
I think they might.
Yeah.
Movies.
Yeah.
Are they going to also? That's weird because those tones are extremely different.
I would love to see like Cameron Diaz or.
But
like
I love the idea.
I sort of like it. You know, I think we all kind of have a fondness for the campy Drew Barrymore one.
Yeah. I love those.
Here's my guess. I'm going to guess that Patrick Stewart is actually playing Charlie. That he poses as Bosley because there's numerous Bosleys are like their operative or like their contact points, but that he is secretly going to be Charlie.
That's an interesting notion. Certainly he's an A-list enough guy to be that guy.
Yeah.
In the Drew Barrymore, wasn't Terrence Stamp Charlie? Didn't like you finally see him at some point?
No, it was John Forsythe.
Oh, it was John Forsythe. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, we saw him in the first one. I mean, we didn't actually see him.
Right. However, the weird thing is, like, the TV show was kind of a somewhat earnest, if TNA-ish, you know, like, mystery investigation show.
But it had a goofy element to it.
Yeah, for sure. There was the, how are they going to disguise themselves and stuff in this one. But then, like, the Drew Barrymore-produced one was, like, super pop.
Yeah.
You know, it was McGee directed, and it was real pop, and it had influences that ranged, I mean, I would say for sure music videos, a little bit of John Woo here and there, and the greatest villain of all time, the Thin Man.
Creepy Thin Man, not just Thin Man.
But I hope he shows up some way on the show if they make it a legacy show.
It's
not a show, it's a movie.
Whatever, movie.
But here's the thing. The second Charlie's Angel, Full Throttle, which is...
Not as good.
Bad. Not good, but it does bring in Demi Moore as an ex-angel,
right? Yep. Right.
And she talks about her in her day they use guns and all that kind of thing. So they already sort of established a bit of legacy.
Yeah, that's true.
I forgot that Demi Moore was in that.
But so was Bernie Mac.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
So.
I honestly think losing Bill Murray was a big part of why Charlie's Angels 2 didn't work as well. Also, giving this weird backstory where Drew Barrymore's character was in the same orphanage as Creepy Thin Man, and he was trying to protect her, and they tried to sort of make him into a good guy.
I forgot that.
It's weird, man. Guys, do not go back and watch Full Throttle. It's worse than you
think
remember.
I think that has to be because, like, who's the actor?
Crispin Glover.
Yeah.
Perfectly cast as super creepy guy.
Yep.
Because he's a super creepy guy.
Yeah.
He's super creepy.
Yep.
But I lost my train of thought. I guess I understand why they might want to make him a quasi good guy because he was so memorable.
Sure.
He was just like, he was a really good, memorable
villain.
I mean,
he was the kind of like the Spike phenomenon on Buffy.
That's the thing, it falls exactly into the Spike. And like, people, let your villains be villains. If they're good villains, don't turn them into heroes.
Yeah.
Except
in the X-Men, in which case that's all you do.
And that's a bad idea because Magneto, you never know where he is anymore.
Yeah,
that's
true.
Sure.
Hero villain.
But I really like this concept. I like the legacy angels. That's a really cool thing.
I like Elizabeth Banks. Also, Pitch Perfect is pretty much exactly the tone I would want for Charlie's Angels.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah.
You know what's funny is the Bond movies, at least in like kind of the planning stages, have struggled for years with, should we make it a legacy series? Should we kind of like loosely say that all of these guys were Bond, and Bond is just a title and all that stuff, and they never quite have gotten around to it. Maybe they will, maybe they won't.
Yeah.
It'd be kind of funny if, like, Charlie's Angels...
Beats them to it.
yeah. Which sounds like they're gonna.
last bit of news, Michael Dante DiMartino and Brian Konietzko, which are the two people who did Avatar, are doing a live-action Avatar for Netflix. I saw the news first.
Like, we should just quick say Avatar the Last Airbender, not Avatar the Blue People one.
Right.
Yes.
Avatar Last Airbender was one of those shows that I absolutely loved. And when I saw they were doing a live action, I was like, why? Why are you doing this? And then I saw it was the original creators. I'm like, oh, okay.
Right. People may, of course, remember there was a hugely hated live action adaptation already that never, I guess, did any subsequent movies that was by M. Night Shyamalan.
He keeps talking about how he's gonna.
Before he kind of redeemed himself with Split and various other movies.
Yep. Visit.
I would have thought that the harsh failure of that movie would have meant that they would never even touch a live action version. But this did they say, I think, reimagining of it?
Yeah.
So they're probably gonna tweak it somewhat.
Well, if you go the route of something like Jungle Book.
Yeah.
Like, that could really work.
Yeah. That piece of art that came with it... Yeah, it had like a long-distance shot, so you couldn't see it well, but essentially a photorealistic, presumably, like, CGI-type APA. Does anybody know if that, like, is actually, like, a production shot?
I think it is. Netflix posted it.
Yeah, that's true. I was wondering if it was that, or if it was just, like, a... Just here's something to get you thinking about it.
Well, Netflix posted it, so I'm going to say it's probably official.
Hmm? How Netflix, for all we know, is going to drop this thing next week.
Yeah, it could be out next week. I've been working on it for 5 years.
They still haven't gotten around to their Watership Down animated thing that's had, like, John Boyega and a couple other big names.
Oh, I'm sure it's in the works. It'll show up.
It'll show up tomorrow.
It'll show up someday. You won't expect it, and there'll be 20 episodes.
but... So my instinct when I first heard about this was, don't like it because I love the animated one
Same.
So much.
Yep. Yep.
But if anyone's going to do it,
yep.
I will allow the original creators might be the right people to do
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
the producers.
Well, and the other thing is, like, there were constraints on them from working at Nickelodeon.
Right.
Like, they had to do a certain thing.
Appa couldn't drop the F-bomb.
Yeah, it had to be aimed a little more at kids. They probably couldn't do the complexities of the story a little bit. I mean, not that they failed in any way.
I was going to say, I feel like... You know, a lot like the Batman the Animated Series being, like, such a perfect balance for Batman. Right. I'm like, in a lot of ways, I think Batman works best being a slightly kiddie thing. You know, I've got projects I like than Batman that were, like, more R-rated, but by and large, I think Batman the Animated Series is the best incarnation. So I don't know that they lost really anything from my perspective from not being able to, you know, show somebody having sex or something.
Yeah, I don't even think it's that. I think they maybe just want to be delving into something that's a little more sophisticated.
Sure.
As far as,
I'm
like,
just sad
going.
We won't get
adult situations.
The same Uncle Iroh.
I know. Well, but what they can do is essentially, they can do their own version of the Hindsight 2020, which is...
Yeah.
They can choose to focus on things that, as they were making the original show, they thought were successful, turn away from directions they thought were less successful.
Yeah.
Because they're not going to just retell the same thing that they've
done before.
Right, they're going to do something different.
It is also, it was like such a good show, and I'm a little saddened to because not everybody knows about it. People still have it. There's lots of people who've never seen Last Airbender.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, so to some degree, I'm like, anything that exposes it to a wider audience, as long as it's quality, I'm kind of okay with.
Yeah.
And I imagine this is probably going to be pretty quality.
I still need to go and finish watching Korra. I never did finish it.
I like
it.
Korra. I know it's not all universally beloved, but I actually really like Korra.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just happy to see more of this world.
Yeah, I am too.
I'm curious to see what they'll do. All right, that's it for us on news. We'll be back in just a second to talk about comics for the week.
One familiar cry.
We're talking comics the week of Wednesday, September 19th, and I'm going to start off this week.
Yep, what you got?
You guys know I'm a huge fan of annuals.
We both liked that Silver Surfer annual the other week.
That's actually true.
There's a trend.
And then there was like an X-Men annual that not too long ago that you actually liked too.
But in general, I hate annuals.
It's true.
And I have long lobbied for their deaths and that we should stop them. They're something from a bygone age. They usually are just for inventory stories. There's nothing useful about them.
even when I was a kid, it was still somewhat rare that there was good ones.
Yeah.
There were a few legendary ones.
Sure.
Everybody...
The West Coast Avengers, East Coast Avengers baseball game, and then Grandmaster versus Death Battle. That was fantastic stuff.
Avengers Annual 8, I think it was, that introduced Rogue to most people. Yep. I don't remember if she'd been around in Captain Marvel before that.
She'd been around somewhere, yeah.
And I think there was a Spider-Man annual that introduced Captain Marvel, the Monica Rambeau incarnation.
Yeah. There were definitely good annuals.
But the vast majority of annuals I got in those days, not
terrible.
Good.
So I generally think annuals should go away. And yet, both my picks this week are annuals. So Captain America annual number one. This is written by Teenie Howard. Artist by Chris Sprouse with Ron Lim also penciling, which is a weird mix.
That is a weird mix.
And it is set in 1944, just outside Germany, as Cap and Bucky basically run into a small group of escapees from a concentration camp. And they are being hunted down by Nazis. And Cap and Bucky sort of hole up in this farmhouse with them and are trying to get them to safety. It's the kind of realism that doesn't always work in Cap, but it works really well here. It also has the benefit of Cap and Bucky getting to punch a bunch of Nazis in the face.
Always a good time.
Which you might, as a woman in comics, the writer Teenie Howard, you might guess that she might have some thoughts on Nazis in comics in the modern day. And I feel like there are some definite subtext here of these heroes kicking Nazis in the face.
Yep.
There's also there's a couple reveals about the prisoners themselves that I found interesting. The actual prisoners that the characters are well done. This gets to be Cap as like inspiration. The chemistry between Cap and Bucky is perfect. It's a really solid one-off story that I really really enjoyed. And then the writer at the end sort of talks about how sort of what it means to her personally, and her connections to sort of the people lost in the Holocaust. And I thought this was just a fantastic story. This could easily have been a very special episode.
Right.
But instead, those are just used as sort of spices of the element. It's definitely a personal story, but it is a story. And it's a great story of Cap and Bucky versus Nazis and on the behalf of people who need their help. So I definitely recommend it.
That's awesome.
Dave?
I need to read that. There's a book I'd been looking forward to from IDW, and I ended up liking it, as it happens. This is their four-issue Dick Tracy miniseries. I think reading a preview about it from like their little IDW promo catalog thing that we handed out for free to people, it worked on me. It got me in a Dick Tracy mood, and I rewatched the weird 90s movie, the quasi-musical with Madonna songs.
Don't laugh at that movie. That movie is great.
I don't believe that's true.
I like the movie quite a bit, though. It is a weird movie. I think no one could disagree that it's very visually inventive, and they use that like literally the color palette of the time,
too, right? Warren Beatty. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It does fall in that kind of slightly weird Batman Returns type of thing, where it's kind of a little weirdly adult at times, like tons and tons of sexual innuendo and stuff with Madonna's character, and occasionally, like, what I'd forgotten is Dick Tracy, as a comic, even though he's known for his larger-than-life villains and stuff, this procedural element is kind of still important. He's like, gotta get a warrant to take down Big Boy and stuff like that. Yep. And
he's a cop.
Big Boy is bought off the district attorney, played by Dick Van Dyke, bringing it full circle there. Yep. It's Dick Van Dyke Day. So there's cartoonish elements in it, but there's sometimes kind of slightly surprisingly grounded police stuff. But overall, the feel is super larger than life. Now, taking it back to the comic, what we've got here is a story that, based on the script that I read, they have the first few pages, the script for it in the back. They outright say that the goal was somewhat like to do what Batman the Animated Series did. Set it in the present, but make it feel like that kind of... an old school vibe to it. It wanted to have some of the visual looks of like 30s and 40s, old school cars and stuff. And indeed, this, by the way, I forgot to mention, it's written by Mike Allred with his brother, and penciled by Rich Tomasso, who, what do we know, Spy Seal?
Yeah.
And what's that weird sort of slice of life book that he did that I kind of liked?
I don't know.
He did something that was like this kind of more grounded thing that was like almost realistic, although it was drawn in his weird Tintin-ish style.
Right.
Anyway, I liked it.
Yep.
So he's a good fit for this. So when it begins, though, to tell you that it is in the present, there is a guy who is... who is he? He's almost like... I can't remember if he's like sort of like a Bill Gates type. Silicon Valley software mogul.
Yeah.
Who's on the run. Let's see, what was he doing? I'm just skimming through it. I guess he was like serial killing people. It sounded they made out that he might have.
It's a chief suspect in Cloud Cam killer case.
Yeah, like he was like the suggestion from the newspaper article is that like the little cameras on your computer or yep. whatever, he was using that to somehow serial kill people. But like a James Bond opening, you're catching the tail end of this. Dick Tracy is tracking him down, boot wow. to the face.
If you read in like the actual newspaper, it's like Peters himself used company access to geo-track young female victims and turn off his own Cloud Peepers security cameras, not some outside hacker as originally thought. That's yeah. some depth, actually.
Yeah, yeah. Interestingly, by the way, the thing you just read, which you can read on the actual newspaper, that's kind of they show in there. In the end, they say, or like in the script, they had all of that and maybe a little bit more, and they're like, include to the artist. There's a note that's like, include as much or as little as you're able to fit on this on the newspaper.
Oh, that's cool.
You know, your call. And he got most of it, the key stuff on there. Anyway, he runs into Dick Tracy, who they're clearly playing as a police tough guy. The kind of interesting thing is, the real-world connection to this is, like, I'm going to say the image of police is a little tarnished right now. And a cop who plays by his own rules, who doesn't like, who will bend those rules and threaten people and stuff like that, can sound kind of villainous.
But here's the thing I think is interesting. That he talks about sort of his... he talks about how he believes in the rule of law and order, and that's right. a different thing.
He's also going after the bosses in this and not doing yeah. that kind of creepy street crime fighting that sometimes can make even Batman look a little creepy.
That's what I like here. Like this is the Elliot Ness and Untouchables kind of thing. Like,
right.
He goes after the...
Right.
And I loved how smart he was. Like, when they talk about him taking a vacation, I'm like, oh, well, I know where this is going.
Yep. So and incidentally, though, the reason I mentioned the tough guy thing, he has, like, a pretty hard tough guy line to this guy as he's shaking down the software mogul. He's like, in case you're thinking about putting up a fight, he's like, I don't throw the first punch, I throw the last, and I don't shoot first, but I shoot to kill. And the guy just, like, faints dead on him. And you find out, they kind of do it, there is sort of a reinvention of Dick Tracy here. They make out that his boss is pissed because this guy was supposed to be untouchable. He's like yeah. kind of above them, and the guy is like, I'm gonna have to, you know, you've created too much heat for our department. I'm gonna have to, you know, ask for your badge. And they make out that Dick Tracy has like been kicked out of a bunch of different cities because he keeps on trying to do the right thing, yeah. and he keeps on running up against like politics and guys who are trying to basically protect that 1%.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's what, like you said, Randy, that does kind of counterbalance it for me, aside from the fact that it also kind of takes place in this fantasy universe, and we've talked about, yeah. like, Die Hard can be perceived as having very right-wing motifs in it, but in the kind of fantasy world of, like, a two-fisted action movie, it all goes down a little bit more easily. It's yep. It can be a fun fantasy. Anyway, he moves on to a city that is being run by one of his, you know, classically known bad guys, Big Boy. Big Boy's got everybody, the mayor and the city attorney in his pocket, and the police chief and all this, except for, like, one person, and they're looking, but they know that they can't just straight out take out the governor. I think that's the, isn't it the governor? So they have this notion that they bring in Dick Tracy, who they, you know, kind of know because he's a famous cop, and they have him clean up a little bit to show, make it look like they're reforming, and then they, like, kind of just, you know, push him out of the spotlight, and they go back to business as usual.
Yep.
Like Randy said, he's pretty smart in this, and he's got his own idea about how to handle the situation. A lot happens in this first issue. I don't want to quite say where it goes, but there are some big-time action sequences. You will get to see, even though this is a present tense and people talk about hackers and stuff like this, Dick Tracy does say, so you want to play rough, eh? And pick up a Tommy gun.
Yep.
And, like, go to town on some people. A number of people get Tommy gun
is very synonymous with Dick Tracy.
Totally, totally. Like, it would feel weird to not have it.
Yeah.
It would feel weird if he picked up, like, an assault rifle. I think that'd be kind of creepy, honestly.
Yeah, it doesn't work. It doesn't jive.
So, but they use the visuals on all the vehicles and stuff like that are all look like 40s cars. Rich Tomasso definitely came through on the artwork. I'd actually seen one preview picture image that I didn't like, but it was based on just a single page, and it was just a particularly kind of oddly angled view of a character.
Yeah, I thought his storytelling was great.
Yeah, totally, totally. He's like solid pro about it, and they set up a cool little mystery in the back that'll lead it into the next issue. So, Being in the sort of Dick Tracy mood that I was, and I was even rereading some of the original strips from the 30s that I've got in a reprint
book. Chester Gould?
Yeah, Chester Gould's original stuff. So this hit me at just the right time, or I kind of prepared myself for it, and I felt like they came through on it. So,
not a lot of people in a Dick Tracy mood.
Yeah, it's true. But, you know, I have a specific fondness for old school comic strips, and
more
I do
people
think,
than you might think.
I was going to say, I think it is actually somewhat more than you might think. Like a lot of icons, I think some people like the idea more than the character. In the same way that, you know, we know there's people who like Superman as an idea. They want Superman t-shirts. They want a Superman neon sign. But if I said, do you want to read this Superman graphic novel we recommend? They're like, no.
When that movie came out, that was sort of a phenomenon because it had so many licensing stuff. I mean, McDonald's did cups for it. Yeah. Blockbuster Video did like a whole line of stuff. Like,
they had to be
had,
like
writing
on. I mean, it was actually scored by Danny Elfman.
Yeah,
right?
Scored by Danny Elfman,
and it had to be, you know, kind of rather writing on the coattails of Batman '89.
Yep.
But and I think it was it considered a flop? Like I know
I
it was
know
like
it was
critically. It's a weird movie.
It
it's
is
a weird
one.
Movie.
Well, there's
but
even
I
talk
don't,
that Warren Beatty wants to do a sequel to it.
Yeah, I think I heard that. That's,
yeah, and I'm like,
crazy.
Dude's in his what?
60s?
I thought he was 70s? In like 70s.
Maybe.
And he's like, still wants to do it. And I'm like, dude, just do it. At
yeah,
this
yeah.
point, I'm like,
well, what's
I want
it gonna do? Get weirder? Sure.
Other than, unfortunately, I believe Tess. Didn't she recently pass away?
Oh, she did. She did. And I love that actress.
Yeah, I can't remember her name.
I'm blanking
Dirty Rotten
too,
Scoundrels.
Which is sad that I can't remember her.
Oh, man, I don't remember her name.
Yeah.
She's in. She was in Future Man. And
yeah, that's her last role.
That was her
so
last role.
Here's what I think they should do. They should have, like, you know, they should go ahead and do this sequel movie. Have Tracy, like, in modern times or whatever. I would actually like it, I think, if it was weird enough to, in some way, maybe comment on things in the present, while at the same time, hopefully, still having some two-fisted action and clear-cut villains. Well, he could be, like, grown up. You know,
he could be like in his 40s now. He could be, like, the actual, like, detective.
Yeah, yeah. You have the kid do that. You have some new ingenue as a love interest or something. You know, obviously subvert what was going on. Don't recreate it exactly.
No.
But I feel like they should run with what they had before and have a strong musical element. You get some strong musical performer who has like some acting chops.
How Lin-Manuel Miranda wants to be in everything.
Dude,
so.
that'd be great. Yes,
he'd
yes.
be the next 88 Keys.
Yes. who is Mandy Patinkin in the movie, which is its crazy star-studded cast, and I think it should have an equally ridiculous star-studded cast.
Yeah, I mean...
By the way, I just wanted to quick mention, just taking it back to the comic for a sec. The main one has a cover by Mike Allred, but that's Rich DeMasso,
that's DeMasso,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
He's doing variant covers for each issue that each one spotlights one of the... Everybody knows that the villains are one of the coolest thing in Dick Tracy, the weirdo villains. And the first one has a big boy cover, and it's like a split frame thing that's got him like...
A mugshot,
and then a kind of stewing, it looks like, in the interrogation room. And it's really beautifully drawn, like the color palette and everything. Tommaso's a super, super great artist.
Well, their big boy is a little different. I can't remember from the original like comic strip if big boy was sort of imposing. I mean, in the movie, he's not super imposing. Like,
right. I believe in the original ones, he kind of was a bit of a knockoff of Edward G. Robinson. Like like everybody parodied in all those old Warner Brothers cartoons and stuff,
yeah.
You know? Gonna rub him out, see? Yeah, I think he even did that affectation of saying
Al Pacino was amazing, but like
arguably
got
like about 10 or 15 minutes
not.
More screen time than he should have, but that was also in the style of Batman 89 with the Joker.
Yes.
Anyway, so Dick Tracy gets a good recommendation from me.
I think we all three enjoyed that one,
yeah.
Actually.
Yeah,
I think we all would definitely recommend.
I think what version you got?
I am going to pick a second issue of a book called West Coast Avengers. Which
I picked the first one. Was that the one I was gone that time. Yep, and I actually picked it. Even though I'm like, this is probably not going to be a book that I necessarily follow. And I actually forgot to read the issue this week, but I did like how it was put together. So
yeah.
So what happens in
the
second?
I mean,
the
second one kind of picks up where the last one left off. There's no land sharks, but there's a giant tiger that the team is fighting.
Yeah. Not tiger, but Tigra, the Avengers who is
from
Avenger,
West Coast
who is Avenger. Furry and has stripes.
Yes, and is just kind of gone animalistic.
And was a founding West Coast Avenger.
And she was a founding West Coast Avenger. Yes, so she is running rampant Godzilla style through the city. There is a emergence of a character named BroDoc, which, what is he? He actually does have an acronym.
Not MODOK.
Right.
BroDoc.
It's something designed only for kissing. Yeah, biorobotic organism designed overwhelmingly for kissing. Which the entire team believes is just a facade for actually MODOK. Just, they even made BroDoc's head a little bit bigger than it should be on his body. So they all think it's definitely MODOK in disguise.
I was looking to see, it does not look anything at all like MODOK. It looks like some beefcake dude with, I guess, a slightly larger than normal head.
Yes. But
he's like a shirtless dude walking around in leather pants.
Yes. That Gwenpool becomes weirdly fascinated by as the,
sure, why not?
The issue continues on. But yes, everyone's convinced that he's MODOK, and of course Clint and Kate decide to go investigate that while the rest of the team kind of watches BroDoc at their base. And decidedly goes into some funny stuff. I really feel like Kelly Thompson has a good handle on the Matt Fraction, Clint Barton, and I like her, Kate Bishop, a lot. There's also...
The tone is not the same as the Hawkeye, though. Like, his character, I think, seems in character, but, like, that tone wasn't goofy in the way this is. It was its own weird kind of...
Goofy.
Yeah.
There was goofiness in Matt Fraction's. Yeah. But there was not kind of this slapstick element, I guess, is right. What I would call this book, but there's some great moments and just the kind of team, which should not be a team. I mean, there's no world where it works where Quentin Quire, Gwenpool, America Chavez, both Hawkeyes are on a team. It just doesn't work. And yet it does somehow. And there's so, specific...
You know, I think, Randy, I believe it was you who compared the first issue somewhat to Next Wave. And your grudging admiration for maybe its craft and its appeal.
Nick made that comparison. Okay. I disagree with it.
I think Nick is right, because who all was in Next Wave? Machine Man, yep, Captain Marvel,
the Captain, which was a new character.
Yep, right. A bunch of weirdos.
Boom, yeah. Boom. I think he's absolutely right to compare it to that.
Yeah.
And honestly, this is not spoiling anything, but Gwenpool and Quentin Quire get in an argument over Weekend at Bernie's 2. And
it's the moment you've been waiting for, Nick.
Talk of a weird movie-like quality. The Weekend at Bernie's movies, not really the second one, but the first one was definitely a movie I watched ad nauseum as a kid.
Yep.
I don't know why I liked Jonathan Silverman as much as I did at that point. I don't know what the other guy went on to do.
Andrew McCarthy?
Oh, yeah, Andrew McCarthy. I forgot that was Andrew McCarthy.
He did all right by himself.
Yeah, he did fine.
I mean, neither of them has worked a lot lately, but...
No, but they...
But in his day, Andrew McCarthy did a lot of stuff.
But, yes, there's even a Weekend at Bernie's joke that goes on a little while and ends in an interesting place. So... Honestly, I just
think this is... If that's not a call to read it, I don't know what is.
I honestly just think it's a good team book. And that wears itself... kind of its humor on its sleeve. Mm-hmm. And the art by Stefano Caselli...
It is not pretending to be a serious book.
No. And Stefano Caselli is doing a really good job as an artist. It's very clear.
There's another Next Wave comparison. You know, Next Wave had the gorgeous art of... a guy's name I suddenly can't
see. Stuart Immonen.
And, Stefano Caselli is, I thought was killing it on the art in the first issue.
Yes.
If this is, I have not read this yet, but if it's anything like that, it was really good.
Yeah. So, I definitely recommend people check out West Coast Avengers. My backup pick is the wonderful book called Black Badge, which I forget who picked it.
I think I ended up picking it.
Dave did, yeah.
Yeah, I picked the first issue.
It's about Black Ops, Boy Scouts.
It is Black Ops Boy Scouts. And this one... basically picks up exactly where the last one left off. They were in, like, the jungle... in Korea, and now they're in Russia.
Yep. I think the baseline premise has it that kids, you know, who are, like, Cub Scouts are kind of considered innocuous and under the radar. They travel around to foreign countries sometimes on field trips and stuff like that. So it's the perfect cover, and they secretly go on missions for the government, right?
Exactly. And because of some of the problems that they had in the last episode... they're sort of being vetted by another team.
Uh-huh.
This one, a sort of Canadian team.
Yep.
And it's awesome. And it is kind of a darker story. It's them actually doing like operations that I would assume like G.I. Joe would do.
Yeah.
Some of the darker stuff, like what Larry Hama would do, that felt more realistic than
right, like,
kind of the crazy.
Not the G.I. Joe cartoon, stuff. But more like, you know, we're
special
gonna
missions.
Yeah, we're
or,
gonna. We're somebody's going to get killed in this.
Right.
Somebody
or we're
you might be
arms
left
to.
Yeah, yeah. Morally ambiguous stuff.
Yes.
I got the impression, and I haven't read this issue all the way through yet, but I got the impression reading an interview or like some opening, some pitch about it from Matt Kent,
mm-hmm.
was that he kind of was gonna maybe use it to like sort of satirize, maybe the modern world and some of the maybe darker elements
yeah.
of America. And I'm like, would you just call it a satirical book? Like, it was hard to... The first issue didn't quite come off as satire.
I don't know if I would call it satire. I mean it's definitely using elements of that, but it's... I don't
feel
satire.
It's taking itself pretty seriously.
I do think it is. I mean, there's definitely some humor to it as well, but it's not, like, making fun of itself or anything like that. One of the characters even gets sort of a kind of melancholy backstory... which may or may not be 100% accurate, but I don't know. Matt Kent's doing a lot of really cool work, and I just like the notion of the Black Badge, sort of these kids who are special ops. Cause
did you ever read, real quick, the Department H?
I read, like, the first issue of it.
If you
Matt Kent,
chance,
sometimes
you might
I go back,
look.
I go back
cool
and forth
mystery.
On his stuff, because I didn't get into that, and then...
Mind Management. I never tried that one.
I read the first volume, and I liked it. I never finished it up.
Okay.
But
the Black Badge stuff is connecting?
Yeah, this is connecting in a way that his other stuff has not. And I really, really love Tyler Jenkins on the artwork.
He's fantastic. I think Matt Kent is going to be one of those guys like Jeff Lemire, who's both of their styles happen to remind me of each other, and even their subject matter sometimes seems a little similar. But I think, and they both have, as artists themselves, they seem to have good taste in picking artists.
Right.
So I think Jeff Lemire is going to work with nothing but good artists for the most part, and I think Matt Kent is going to be that have that same quality.
Yeah, I don't know quite who Jenkins reminds me of most. I mean, it's a little like Kevin O'Neill.
I mean, he's not unlike what Kent does.
Yeah, and also
he
like Kent.
His own art.
But he also reminds me a little bit of, I'm just blanking.
There's
on
like
names.
An angularness
is it Sean,
to his.
Sean Phillips, is that who Brubaker works with?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It reminds me
a little bit of that
as far as like
the heavier
blacks too on like the and on the characters and that kind of slightly noirish quality.
I also love that one of the Canadian group has a puppy. It's like it's an actual rescue dog. Actually rescues people. There's just little elements in here that really kind of leads me to believe that Matt Kent has really fleshed this world out and kind of I feel like there's a binder sitting on his desk that
with
is just full
notes.
Of notes.
I hate to say it, but because I don't like things in their native medium, but I have a strong feeling that this will be made into a movie or TV show in the next 5 years.
Yes, I can see that. Dave, what is your backup?
My backup pick is something I was not particularly looking forward to. It is Return of Wolverine number one. Now, I think we had all liked Charles Soule's introduction to the what was the Hunt for Wolverine. That his intro and like his own mini series in there that had Daredevil and some other guys on the trail, but kind of felt it was overall a bloated event. And like by the end of its little multiple mini series, I was not enthused for anything Wolverine.
It's true.
And so I was like, well, I'm probably not going to be into this. But I read the first issue and I found it had a lot of things that I liked. And it also managed to maintain some mystery. Nick, you guys seen Dark City before?
Yeah.
Know how it opens with the dude? He wakes up like with no memory. He's in a hotel room. There's like a naked dead woman next to him with like ritualistic knife marks on her, and he's like covered in blood. And the police are coming.
Yes,
like it's a kind of a fun, crazy opening, and that's what happens almost here. Wolverine, who we have not seen in some time, and who we only know from trailer previews and stuff, is going to have some kind of weird thing where his claws heat up, which I thought sounded ridiculously stupid. They don't fully get into it in this, so I don't know what the deal is. But he like wakes up, they're extended and glowing, and he looks around and there's a bunch of dead people around him in the room. Lots of dead people, blood everywhere. One or two of these people have been decapitated. There are, like, computer banks that looks like Weapon X-ish. It has a saber-toothed tiger in one of them. Weird, mysterious stuff. And there's a dying guy who he goes to talk to. And he talks to the guy for a few minutes, And the guy says some really interesting stuff that kind of sets the mystery in motion. Wolverine does, he has kind of like lost his memory. But while that sounds so pat and old school for Wolverine, the way he's regaining it is kind of the way I like, where he is Wolverine, the Wolverine you know. He's got his morality, he's smart, and he moves on information quick. He's got his hunter's instinct, but he just doesn't know what the hell is going on. And
it's sort of in the reader's point of view, in
right?
A lot of
right.
Ways.
Wolverine is our eyes on, and I think that was a good way to do it. It reminded me; it took elements of the actual classic Barry Windsor Smith Weapon X thing.
I will say they are straight up like panels that Adam Kubert has resurrected from.
But I thought it was McNiven.
Steve McNiven.
But it is inked to who inked it?
But I mean, like, I know that this panel. That's part. I mean, that's like the last page of.
Okay, the inker is somebody I don't know the name. Jay Leiston.
He's done a bunch of stuff.
Okay, and he is inking it in a style that recalls Barry Windsor Smith's artwork on that seminal Wolverine project.
Yeah.
The way the blood is drawn, the details on the characters.
Yeah, that Weapon X miniseries is. Charles Soule is definitely touchstoning off of it, too, because there are elements all throughout.
And it is almost, not quite real time, but it feels like everything occurs in almost real time as Wolverine goes, he's like, okay, I have some information to go on now. What is the next step of this puzzle? Now, it's not so simple as he just goes from point A to point B to point C, but that's what he's attempting to do. And along the way, he's kind of getting almost this internal monologue from, like, past live version. We already talked about how one of the things we liked about Soule is how he incorporates Wolverine's history.
Mm-hmm.
And here, like, he'll be, like, looking, catch a reflection in, like, a splash of blood of, like, and it'll be, like, him with the Weapon X, that VR helmet on, or patch, or something like that. And it's almost like he's having an internal monologue with himself, and exactly, what's happening, you don't know. There's also a sort of dreamlike sequence for his captor, the woman that we met in the Hunt for Wolverine miniseries. What's her name? She's some... I don't know if it means something, anyway, this mysterious woman who had the kind of weird outfit. He has these, like, dreamlike sequences that are clearly metaphorical, where he's, like, walking through a prison, and in all the prison cells are incarnations of him over the years, you know, different roles, different looks and stuff he's had, and they're, like, you know, telling him not to let them out, and I thought one of the things that, and it's clear, it looks like it's, like, a dreamlike thing with, like, endless cells in it. I thought it was kind of interesting that when he does get a chance in this dream structure to release the first one, that one is the Wolverine in costume.
Yep.
That Wolverine is like, oh, decided to let me out first, huh? And Wolverine tells to himself, he's like, guess so, word is, I'm a superhero, and, like, his other self says, hell yeah, we are. So I kind of appreciate, like, I feel like Soule philosophically is where I want Wolverine to be, which is a guy who kind of accepts that he's got a heroic role, even though he's clearly going to go about it in a kind of violent way. And there are some badass action sequences in here. Wolverine makes this motorcycle assault on a base that's a really cool showdown. Clearly not above using a gun when needed to.
Sure.
He's got military training. There's some little hints of some of who he's up against here that calls back some old foes. But mostly what I'm kind of fascinated about is the mystery of exactly what is going on. It clearly has to do with, you know, everybody knows that Wolverine, the stories around him revolve around his genes and trying to recreate that bestial warrior and stuff and, you know, use it to create super soldiers and stuff like that. And there are elements of that in this, but they have a sort of more specific plan going on, and it's pretty intriguing. I liked all of it. I liked who is it? There's like a nurse that Wolverine runs into who has a really interesting conversation with him. Like, Soule, one of the things I like about him is the balance he finds between there's like action in this, there's kind of intrigue and mystery, there's good character downtime moments, and drawn by Steve McNiven, like, you know it's going to look really good. He gets his costume on it that I don't like before the thing is out, but based on where it comes from, it actually does sort of fit.
Yeah. I figured there would be a story reason.
And I did too. But I still don't know how I'll go with it overall. But it's kind of fits the darker place he's in right now. Man, that is, doesn't that look just like Barry Windsor Smith's art right there?
Oh, yeah. Like I said, they're
homages. I've rarely seen an inker, like, so capture somebody's art style without being them. Anyway, just like the lead into Hunt for Wolverine, it just sort of hit all the right notes for me. And surprised me by taking a character who I like, but don't seek out too often. And telling a compelling story with him. Like, I'm actually interested to see what Sewell is going to do with his crazy heat claws and all that. See this mystery unfold. Watching Wolverine bloodily try to figure things out it's a good time.
I agree.
Randy?
My other pick is also an annual. It's Amazing Spider-Man Annual number 1. It's written by Saladin Ahmed, who's been doing Exiles and a few other books. And I generally have not been a fan of his writing. Artist is Gary Brown, who's a longtime inker of John McRae. But this really works. This is a story of back when Spidey first got the black costume, which was early when I was starting to read the comics. Yep.
I believe, like, real time-wise was, like, 1985 or so.
He's dating Black Cat. He's working at the Bugle still. And the black costume, basically, there was a big... The big black costume story was basically that it was an alien parasite. He didn't know it. And it was running him around town while he was asleep.
It would almost like tranquilize him.
Yeah.
And then like go off and have these weird adventures and like violently attack criminals or something. But they like didn't show much of it.
Yeah. And he thought he couldn't figure out why he was so tired all the time, even though he'd been sleeping. It's because, and this is all from the point of view of the costume. So all the narration is the costume talking about how his friend, and he's going to replace his friend's skin, and it's a little weird and creepy.
Right.
But it's also like,
that's what symbiotes are like.
This weird sort of baby version of the costume that's like, it doesn't understand that it's hurting people. So it's like, he's out there like bashing in, the people he rescues are horrified, and he's bashing people's heads in. And it is all about the costume sort of learning, and it runs in with this kid who's like, hey, you're kind of violent for Spider-Man. which leads him into a conflict with Hammerhead. It's basically the alien costume saga from the alien costumes point of view, and it works way better than I thought it would. It's very interesting. It's as someone who's not really a huge Venom fan, I was surprised how much I enjoyed this.
We clearly need to make a display of surprisingly good annuals.
Yeah, yeah.
because we've like hit three in like the last two or three weeks.
Yes. Also on my list this week, X-Men Gold number 36, which is the final issue. It's a good sort of standalone. It's one of those stories about mutants, prejudice, and what that means, and it ties back into some early stuff for the series, and it also ties up some stuff with some of the romantic subplots with Rachel and Nightcrawler. They're left a little bit hanging, and there's a letter at the end from Mark Guggenheim talking about how his, like, early on, he was such a big fan of, like, the Kitty Pryde issue, and... When he was first...
You're talking about Claremont's stuff?
Yeah, Guggenheim is basically talking about how when he, as a preteen, his first exposure to the X-Men and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, he and I must be close to the same age because the stuff he was reading is very close to right where I was coming in.
So basically he talks about this book, he's like, this was conceived as a love letter to that era, sometimes the expense of some originality, I admit, and he talks about being... This is very much a nod to how much he wanted to write X-Men Gold. He goes with the quote, "Nothing Gold Can Stay" by Robert Frost. And all I can think is that this wasn't supposed to end.
Yeah.
I feel like Marvel was like, we're gonna redo things, we're gonna do Uncanny, so we're gonna close down your book. And I'm like, man, I was loving this book. It goes out strong, and I'm really kind of mad that Marvel is ending it, because I think it's great.
I was going to say, if there's a few plot threads left dangling, nothing could be more Claremontian than that.
Reasonable, yeah. But it's a good final issue, and I would definitely recommend anyone who's an X-Men fan should read all of X-Men Gold. It is the best X-Men has been in decades. Injustice vs. Master Universe number 3 continues to be weird and fun. Skyward number 6 starts a new story arc for the Image series where gravity has been eradicated. And... introduces another weird sci-fi element. I love how strange this book is. Immortal Hulk number 6, more of the what's going on with the Hulk, what's going on with Sasquatch, and brings Hulk into conflict with the Avengers. Venom First Host, the weekly series that has Venom versus the Kree and Skrull. Another solid issue. I'm actually really, really liking that book. Doctor Strange number 5 sort of wraps up Mark Waid's first arc and has dragged me back into being more interested in the book. I liked where he finally went with that. Edge of Spider-Geddon number 3 is Jason Latour, the guy who created co-created Spider-Gwen in Edge of Spider-Verse, co-creates a new Uncle Ben Spider-Man, where basically gets a blood transfusion from Peter, and the two of them are Spider-Men together. It has really pretty art from Tunsi Zunjic. It is a weird little book.
Yeah, he's got, I think people who like, say, Marcos Martin's art and stuff like that would probably dig that style.
Black Hammer Age of Doom number 5 gives the answer to what exactly was going on with the small town.
Really?
Yep.
Whoa.
Just go flat out resolves it. Flavor number 5 continues to be a really fun image book about fantasy and cooking. And then a couple trades I want to mention. The Skyward trade, which I mentioned earlier, it's this weird sci-fi book. It's $10. It's one of my favorite reads of this year. I actually really like that book. And then Star Trek Next Generation Through the Mirror, the second part of their Mirror Universe stuff is collected in a trade. Really liking these as well, and glad to get that collected. Dave?
Let's see, just a few I wanted to mention. There was a latest issue of Britannia Lost Eagles of Rome, the mystery set in ancient Rome with some supernatural elements. They did a kind of cool director's cut of Gideon Falls, Jeff Lemire's, I'm going to say somewhat David Lynchian mystery suspense with a little bit of horror mixed in story. So what this is from, I haven't like looked at it closely, but it's a black and white version of the issue. Actually, I think they have a little bit of minimum color to help you delineate the word balloons and stuff occasionally. Mm-hmm. You get all the original art, Andrea Sorrentino's black and white artwork. Then that follows with, I don't know if it's a script for the entire issue. It looks like it's his complete script. So if anybody ever wants to see how Jeff Lemire writes, this is the one to check it out with. And I think that's it. Like, it's like the art in its raw form, and then these script in the raw form. So it's kind of cool little look for you process fiends out there, or just anybody coming into Gideon Falls a little late. And lastly, wanted to mention an interesting book from Aftershock called Patience, Conviction, Revenge. Each one of those has an exclamation point after it, so you can't just say it casually. This is something I didn't finish reading before we started podcasting, but did grab me with a really good first page. It's set in like kind of an apocalyptic sort of wasteland, you know, think a little bit Mad Max or what's that game where you're like all future bounty hunters and stuff like that?
Borderlands.
Yeah, also Borderlands. And I say that too because there's like some smart-ass robots and stuff in this. He's got a lot of robots and has an ongoing back and forth kind of dialogue with a robot that works with him that actually has some very clever and fun dialogue. They're out on a mission and they in this kind of desertish type landscape, and they run into what is it? It's sort of like a kind of a cult, and I have no idea where this is going other than like every panel I was like, oh, this is actually kind of interesting. Oh, that's a kind of a cool idea, or that's a funny and kind of acidic bit of conversation. I don't know quite who to like recommend it to, but like maybe like people liked what was the cemetery book that Warren Ellis wrote last week?
Cemetery Beach.
Yeah, people who are like liking that kind of stuff or might want to check it out if you kind of have any fondness, honestly, for like the kind of weird dystopian type stuff, Fallout or Borderlands is actually the closest thing I can think of to it. Check out Patience, Conviction, Revenge.
Nick?
A few more to add. Mr. Miracle sees its penultimate issue with number 11. Big stuff are revealed. If you've been enjoying the series, this is sort of the oh shit issue.
Interesting. Are reveals happening and stuff,
yes,
you said?
Yes. Infinity Warps Soldier Supreme number 1, which is a two-issue miniseries focusing on Steve Rogers as sort of a mystical Sorcerer Supreme. Sort of takes place right when he gets his abilities and goes from there. I like the world building. I like the sort of mashup.
Did the entire world change or just him?
So Gamora folded the world in half.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's how everything is merged. So, yeah, there's a mashup of two, a Cap and a Doc Strange villain. It is very much Amalgam minus the DC.
Exactly. Right. And, you know, he was created through magic instead of through science. There's some neat ideas. Yeah, there's some really, really neat ideas. I definitely recommend it.
Also, the Soldier Supreme comes with sour cream and guacamole, I believe.
Yes.
I guess if you ever want to see Cap magically generate his shield,
yeah,
that was neat.
Cool. This might be the book for
or
you.
Or Cap with a beard.
Or Cap with a beard.
Or a
Stephen with Strange. A Doctor Strange.
With Doctor Strange beard.
A Lemmy style mustache.
Yes. Thor number 5, which sees Old Man Thor versus a Phoenix infused Old Man Logan.
Okay.
Set in the millions of future, million years in the future. It's a good one-off for Jason Aaron. I kind of like going back to what he did in The God Butcher, where he's telling different points of view from various Thor, from various points in time. Then Justice League number 8, which sees the Legion of Doom make a deal with the Joker Batman from the Dark Multiverse that continues to stay around. So it's a lot of him and Lex. Venom number 6, which is the finale to the first story arc that Donny Cates has, is kind of a badass action sequence versus Eddie Brock versus the giant dragon and kind of leader of the symbiotes. Life of Captain Marvel number 3 has come out, which is the third issue of sort of the backstory for Carol Danvers as she visits her hometown and deals with kind of, you know, a brother that's been injured and sort of her mom and a few things. Lots of big reveals in that one. And then there are a few Batman books. Batman 55, which I'm not going to go into very much, but some big stuff is happening in Batman's world yet again.
Yep. For those who, I mean, there's like, this is stuff that could like even, like spoilers are going to get out about
spoilers
it. Like, big
are
things
get out.
Do happen in it.
Yes. So yes, it's definitely one to check out. It is kind of dark, I have to say.
Tom King, dark.
I know.
from the Horse Killer.
But
but not as dark.
Not as dark as the next Batman book, which is basically, I guess, the second entry in the DC Black Label, because they're doing White Knight as the first.
But it's the first original
story.
But
it's the first original story, Batman Damned. Which is Brian Azzarello and Lee Bermejo's sort of entry. It's oversized.
It's like magazine size.
Magazine size. It's beautifully rendered. I mean, yeah. Bermejo is definitely one for detail, and you get a lot.
He's very much working in what I would say is almost like, kind of like Christopher Nolan movie style plus even, you know, like even with extra detail.
But the story is sort of a basic Batman kind of going insane in some ways as the Joker's body is found and he doesn't quite remember if he's done it. This is also...
It's a supernatural story.
It's a supernatural story, guest starring everyone's favorite Brit, John Constantine. So yeah.
I don't know if I should say who, but there's like at least two or three other notable magic characters in it.
Yes. I am not going to spoil. I think people should just enjoy it.
Yeah, it's a big... This is a big notable launch, and people should check it out.
Exactly. But that is all that I have.
Also, it's giant.
It is.
I really like the formatting of it.
Yeah, like, I think the formatting...
Well,
I wasn't
if you're
going to
like launch
it.
Kind of a whole line of... It's kind of going to be these kind of like... DC... What's the line called? DC?
Black Label.
Black Label. That's going to be their kind of edgier stories. Actually having a different format like that...
My only concern is... We don't have sleeves, and we don't bag and boards.
That is going to drive several people completely insane.
Is it by chance the right size for a magazine bag and board? It's in that ballpark.
It's possible. Now, are all Black Labels going to be this size?
I don't know.
Probably not.
Let's bring back the Treasury Editions.
But I can see them doing it for Bermejo's art. And people should embrace the difference and the change and the excitement of something
new. I agree.
Yeah. All right, that'll wrap it up for us this week. We'll be back next week with more. Until that time,
Yo, Joe!
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating and review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.